You are listening to Kilometre Zero by the Cycling Podcast. Powered by Zwift, the fitness app where fun is fast.
What's our bedtime reading this evening, Richard? Are you going to read us a story?
The Tour de France by Christopher Thompson. Have you ever seen this book, Lionel? You come across this one before?
I have seen the cover. I've never seen the actual book itself. I mean, it pops up on sort of Amazon recommendations every now and again, that sort of thing. But I've not actually read the book, no.
I can't remember why I read it, because there are lots of books about the Tour de France. This one's just called The Tour de France. But it's by an academic, a professor of history, Chris Thompson. And something prompted me to read it, and I was absolutely blown away by it. The detail in it, he's a proper historian. He's gone into the archives of all the French newspapers. He's gone right back to the start of the tour, and even before the start of the tour, to really set it in its historical context. And it's a book about France, and it's a book about the race in France and what it meant to France, and all the kind of cultural aspects of the Tour de France, of France at that time. And I find it absolutely riveting. There's so much detail in it that I didn't know. I learned a lot, and it was great. But we were put in touch with Chris Thompson through his brother Richard Thompson, who emailed the podcast, didn't he?
He did, yeah. He's a listener to the podcast, and well, that's how the connection came about. And you spoke to him shortly before the Tour de France started about the cultural foundations of the Tour de France and why it was so important to the entire nation's psyche at the beginning, really. Francois, you must have an angle on this.
Well, I listened to a bit of the the episode in the car, and yeah, it actually really rang a bell, because, as you know, I've written quite a few books on sports history, and it's amazing that very often the best historical books about France are written by Americans, because I mean they do a serious job, they dig very deep in the archives and they don't have the limitation of French historian, the political probably limitations, or how could I put it? Yeah, not too close. That you can't see things when you were too close to them, and so the insight he was putting about France and the Tour de France were really interesting. Lots of things are now quite well known. The fact that the defeat against Prussia in 1870 spurred the French nation to try to rejuvenate, because they all of a sudden there was this impression that the Germans, the Brits, I mean, all our neighbors were in better health than the French. But there's lots of I need to read the book, because I'm sure there's much more in there than even stuff I know about.
But anyway, there's lots of rich detail in this book, and we all think we know the Tour de France really well. I learned an awful lot about the race from reading this book. So let's cross over now to Chris Thompson.
My father was worked for the U.S. government, and we were posted in a number of countries. And in the early 70s, in the summer of 71, he was posted to Brussels, Belgium. And I was about to turn 12. I'm the oldest of three brothers. And we were there for 4 years. And it coincided with the sort of second half of the really successful part of Eddy Merckx's career. I guess the whole career was successful. But we left just after he lost the yellow jersey to Thévenet in the 75 Tour. And my youngest brother, Rich, who's also a passionate cycling enthusiast, and we've ridden together in France and in the U.S., he and I became huge fans. We discovered this sport on the French language and Flemish language TV. We knew how to ride bicycles, but we had no clue that there was this extraordinary sport. So we discovered Paris-Roubaix, the cobblestones. And of course, we were in a country where cycling is, along with soccer, and in some moments ahead of soccer, the national sport. And to be there at the time of Eddie Merckx's reign just made it all the more exciting because of the, you know, his panache, his attacking style. Even when he was in the yellow jersey, he would attack. And so we, of course, were very drawn to that as well. I went to the French school in Brussels at that time, the Lycée Français, and I would, as long as weather permitted, which it usually did, I would cycle to school and back. And of course, in my head, I was a Tour de France racer, you know, sprinting up the hills and coming down them and stuff. And then even my youngest brother and I, Rich, and I would do time trials around our block. So we just became obsessed with it. And so that's where the sort of interest in the sport began, but I never anticipated writing a book about it.
Yeah, I mean, were you a keen historian even then, and was the history of the sport something that drew you into it as well?
To some extent, there was a wonderful magazine, I don't think it exists anymore, called the Miroir du Cyclisme. And so I began to buy that and put the posters of great cyclists up on my wall. And they would often cover, you know, the careers of cyclists from decades earlier, including sort of black and white posters of them in action. And so I became interested as a fan would, as a, you know, teenage boy would in their favorite sport, in the sort of the history of the sport. But I actually majored in college in French literature and became a high school French teacher. And in the summers, I started getting a master's in sort of French culture, French civilization, French history, French literature as well. That's when I got interested in history, and I ended up going back and getting a PhD in French history. And the crucial moment was I was in a seminar with a very prominent but still quite young French scholar, and he was talking about 20th century French cultural history, and he just tossed out this remark during one of the seminars where he said the 1930s, which was the great era of popularity for the Tour de France bicycle race. And none of my classmates, of course, it didn't register with them, but I'm walking out with one of them and I said, I wonder if there's a dissertation topic there, you know, because I'd never thought of it as, I never thought of, you know, a sporting event as being an interesting window into the history of a country. And that's what it became for me.
And that's what your book is, really, I suppose. I mean, it's such an interesting window into France, and so much about the Tour de France as it is now makes more sense when you read the book and understand the context and some of the themes, I suppose, that have been there right from the start. But, you know, for those not familiar, can you tell us a little bit about what France was like, and in particular the sort of, I guess a lot of us have this image or sense of France as being a very confident nation with confident people. And reading your book and understanding a bit about where France was at the end of the 19th century after the Franco-Prussian War, it seems like a very different place.
That's exactly right. You know, so you have the Napoleonic era and this notion of France as la grande nation, the great nation, you know, exporting democratic values, but also winning major battles. And of course, then Napoleon gets defeated at Waterloo in 1815. But by the late 1800s, France was, as you point out, you know, rather insecure nation. They're coming off the defeat in the Franco-Prussian War of 1870. They're taking a third stab at democracy with the Third Republic, but lots of French people are opposed to a democratic form of government. So this republic is very insecure politically. There are conservative Catholics and right-wing nationalists and monarchists and Bonapartists, and there's a whole range of opponents. The other major factor at that time was the French population was stagnating. Demographic trends were very poor, and there were some years in the late 1800s where there were more deaths in France than births. And so they have this increasingly rich, industrializing neighbor, unified Germany, that has just defeated them, and right next door. And so there was a huge amount of insecurity about that. And then, of course, Europe is getting increasingly tense in the couple of decades before the outbreak of World War One. And so, yes, this was a time of really serious insecurity. And so this notion of fin de siècle, end of the century, is not a positive one.
There's a great quote from a historian in your book about the Franco-Prussian War, someone whose name I don't have, but he describes it as a triumph of German legs. And that resonates for the cycling fans.
Exactly.
Especially.
Exactly. So coming off, you've lost a major war, and you have a stagnating demographic trends at a time when you want to be producing as many future soldiers as possible to take revenge on Germany. And so yes, that the analysis was one of the reasons that the Germans won was that they were just fitter. And so there was a mounting obsession in France in the late 1800s about, they actually created a word called dégénérescence, degeneration, but a new word for degeneration. They had this deep sense of a potential fatal decline. And as you point out, it was physical, largely physical, but also kind of moral. They didn't have the willpower to confront the challenges of the late 19th century. And so sport became, for many commentators and activists, a solution to that. You could return France to greatness if you produced healthy generations of young French men.
The best history, I suppose, encourages you to look afresh at, you know, all the things that were going on at a particular time. And the modern Olympics were founded by a
exactly.
Frenchman as well at the same time. But was that sort of explicit at the time? Was it something that people were conscious of? Were these things, the Olympic Games, the Tour de France, seen as being a potential solution to these problems, do you think?
Absolutely. Pierre de Coubertin, the French aristocrat who revived the Olympic movement, founded the modern Olympic Games in 1896, he was motivated by two major factors. One was he thought that international competitions in a very tense, polarized Europe would increase the prospect of peace between nations. And that goes back to this notion that the ancient Greeks had of a sacred truce during the Olympic Games. But he was also fully conscious of what he saw as the physical and moral decline of his own country. And he had been to England and visited the boarding schools there, where sport was really a big focus. And so he was inspired by that as a way of regenerating the French nation in particular. Now, the Tour de France comes along in 1903. So cycling, competitive cycling, and cycling as leisure, as a leisure activity, has been around for a few decades. There were doctors, there were many prominent physicians who argued that it would revive the French nation. Now, there were other doctors who argued the opposite, that it was going to increase all sorts of illnesses. It would harm women's reproductive organs. Some of them argued it would harm men's reproductive organ. So there was a major medical debate at the time. It wasn't like there was a consensus about cycling as the solution, but a lot of people felt sport in general was the solution, and that cycling was increasingly one of the sports that could help the French recover.
You mentioned female cycling. I mean, that's one of the really fascinating parts of the book for me, the sort of gender politics of it, and the bicycle as a symbol of female emancipation, and the threat that posed or was perceived to pose to French malehood, I suppose, and a lot of the preoccupations of the time. And again, that's so interesting, just thinking about all the current debates around women's cycling and there not being a women's Tour de France. You know, you can trace it. You can trace it back to those anxieties, those fears in the late 19th century, can't you?
I think you can. And I mean, things obviously have evolved over the last 100+ years. But I was just reading on L'Equipe's website yesterday that Christian Prudhomme, you know, the organizer of the Tour, has decided to do away with the classic young, attractive women who appear with the stage winners and the cyclists wearing the jerseys to reward them at the end of each stage. And he is now going to make it one young man and one woman. And so he, you know, here we are, 2020, this issue of how do women fit into the rituals, into the sport of cycling, you're exactly right. It's still an issue. And back in the late 1800s, early 1900s, it was a huge issue, because if cycling was going to be one of the sports that proved that the French manhood was being regenerated, and you know, future soldiers would reclaim the lost provinces of Alsace and Lorraine from Germany in a successful war of revenge, then what does it mean if women are able to cycle just as fast and have the same kind of endurance? Then that does seem to be a sort of slap at French manhood. And so there was an immense debate about whether women should cycle. And there was also concern about whether they would harm their reproductive organs and thus the demographic challenges facing France would continue. And this, you know, as a grad student, as I was reading the archival material and going through doctors' writings from the period, I had not anticipated this. There was a pretty significant debate amongst the medical community about whether women would forego their husbands' beds because they were using the bicycle as an instrument of masturbation. This was being debated at medical conferences, being written about in medical articles. Cycling in particular, not all women's sports, if you can remain quote-unquote feminine, conventionally feminine like you can in tennis, women can still wear a skirt, and they wore long skirts originally, then that was less provocative. That didn't seem to challenge French masculinity the same way. But women cyclists did, because the male cyclists, particularly the tour cyclists, were celebrated for their endurance, their toughness, their grittiness, as they are still today. And if a woman can do that, then are you really a man, according to the gender philosophy of the time?
That's so interesting. And, you know, one of the reasons, as you sort of suggest, for the fear was that women were pretty good, and especially over long distances. And they were they had to be sort of prevented from racing, charged more for lessons and so on. And it's possible to sort of imagine a whole alternative history of the sport where, you know, it would be unusual if there was complete parity given the state of other sports. But women's cycling had to come from so far back to even get to where it is now that you can imagine a completely different landscape had that not been the case at the time.
I think so. I mean, because the female build, when you think of climbing up mountains, you know, I'm a 6'4" guy in the, you know, it's a little over 200 pounds. So I know that it's not easy when you're a big guy. And so you think of the kinds of builds like Egan Bernal, you know, how slight he is, and some of the other great cyclists, it really helps to have a slight build. Well, you know, that's going to be more natural for a lot of female athletes than for a lot of male athletes. So yes, and then the endurance side of things, I'm not saying that they'd have the same power in a time trial or whatever, obviously, but they were really held back. It wasn't until, you know, as I talk about in my book, I think 1984, that you had the first women's tour. And so you think about, you know, how women had been able to already participate in other sports prior to that at a high level. And so, yes, cycling held them back, kept them out for a lot longer. I think part of it was also that, like I said, there are certain sports that were okay for women because they could maintain conventional feminine norms. But a female cyclist wears a very tight fitting outfit. She tries to be as skinny as possible, and so the sort of conventional female form is undermined. The curves, etc., that go into sort of conventional femininity are seen as challenged and undermined by cycling. And I think in France in particular, in countries where there were pretty conventional gender orders and where feminism had a hard time breaking in, that was an issue too, I think, how they appeared. They looked exactly like men.
And yet, the irony is that the giants of the road, and increasingly so, you know, fit this sort of classic feminine build, you know, slender. They even shave their legs. You know, it's one of the great ironies of the sport, I suppose.
That's a very good point. I think you're exactly right.
You are listening to Kilometre Zero by the Cycling Podcast, powered by Zwift, the fitness app that turns indoor riding into a game. Explore endless roads, race riders from all over the world, and boost your fitness with monthly training plans and structure workouts. Join the world's training playground where fun is fast. Go to Zwift.com and start your free trial.
Hi, I'm Edvald Boasenhagen, and I'm riding for NTT Pro Cycling, and I'm going to ride my 10th Tour de France this year. With Zwift, I think it's just I'm not the guy that chats and speak too much when I'm riding, but it's nice to actually see other people and, you know, they do the same work as I do. And it's, yeah, you can have some competitions on the sprints and KOMs, which is nice at times. And also it's inspiring just to see so many other people riding there. But the best thing, I think, is just that actually it feels like you are riding outside with the resistance on the home trainers and things like that. It makes it a lot better than just put on a movie and ride the steady, like the old trainers or like you used to do. But I've been on Zwift since it came, and it's been changing my way of doing indoor training.
I mentioned earlier that, you know, your preface that you wrote around about the sort of, I suppose, the nadir of the sport, 2006, 7, 8, the book came out, it's dominated by doping. I think there was a sense reading that you had that, you know, the sport or the Tour de France was in a sort of existential crisis as a result of this. And I just wonder, it's really interesting you talk about the fans and the responsibility or the role of the fans in changing that culture or not. I wonder where you stand now. I mean, if you're writing a new preface now, how might it have changed, or has it changed?
I was writing that preface in 07 for the paperback edition that came out a year later. And you're right, we were the sort of the, you know, Floyd Landis had just been found to have doped, and there were other doping cases. And the German TV station was refusing to show the tour. I mean, said it would refuse to show the tour until the sport cleaned up its act. It didn't want to be promoting a whole bunch of dopers, you know, to its viewership, and I suppose just especially young future athletes. And so, I mean, I'm not naive. Obviously, there's still doping in cycling like there is in any other major competitive sport. But I do believe that it's been cleaned up substantially from the sort of EPO era. It doesn't mean, I mean, some racers are still being caught out. There's still some, you know, doctors involved in the sport that one raise our eyebrows when you hear the name. But I do feel that there was a somewhat successful attempt to clean it up, to clean up its image, but also to clean up the performances to some extent. Now, the doping goes back to the very beginning of cycling, but it wasn't yet illegal or against regulations. That didn't happen until after World War II. So that the sport has this history from the very beginning of cyclists looking for ways to make this incredibly hard, painful sport a little easier. So I think that, you know, the sport is in much better shape than I thought it might end up being when I was writing that preface.
Something that occurs to me, because you talk about the media sort of reinforcing an awful lot of you know, aspects of the culture around the sport, including the doping. And I wonder if social media has had a role in that. You know, it's not a great sort of comment on the traditional media, but there's something about social media that is just even more forensic and ferocious in a way.
You know, I had not thought about that, but my brother was much, you know, has been active, or years ago was active. Back in the Armstrong days, he was on chat rooms and stuff, and and actually communicating with somebody who was very involved in the whole Armstrong issue, and was badly treated by Armstrong. And I'm not going to say anything more. But I think you're right. It's a way for fans who are invested in the sport and in a clean sport to monitor things, but also to get their views out. And so it becomes increasingly difficult for organizers, for the team sponsors, for the racers themselves to ignore that, because you're exactly right. It's sort of a movement from below that could really topple the sport if it's not paid attention to by the stakeholders in the sport.
I think that was very important in forcing the Armstrong case into the light, if you like. It took years, and a lot of it was crazy, and there were a lot of conspiracy theories, you know, and you get those extreme views, but there's a truth in there somewhere that sometimes has to be pulled sort of kicking and screaming into the light.
Yeah, you're right, and it, with the current social media, it can't be buried. Anybody who wants to revive it and bring it to the light again can do so.
Yeah, social media must be a nightmare for historians, or for future historians.
Yes, I'm. I'm. I'm working on a completely different project where the social media issue is not, you know, doesn't. But you're right. I've said this to my students. Imagine if you're a historian in 50 or 100 years and you're working on the late 20th, early 21st century. I mean, it's not like your primary source material is going to be limited. It's going to be limitless. So how are you going to actually address, the stuff I worked on? I looked at certain public opinion polls, etc. But now, you know, you've got all the social media in terms of trying to figure out how the public felt about something and its role in a particular issue. It's going to be, yes, an extraordinary challenge.
Very curious to ask you about World War II and France during World War II and the Tour de France, and how important it was by then as a sort of national institution in France, and the, you know, the government's attempts to run a sort of alternative Tour de France, and then the sort of battle over the rights to it post World War II. There was tons in that. It's not the same at all, because we haven't missed a year. But one of the great sayings about the Tour de France is it only stops for world wars.
But exactly,
it has been stopped at least temporarily by COVID, and who knows whether this year's race will reach a conclusion. Can you see any parallels at all in terms of, does something like this just restate its importance, or what does it do? How does it assert itself?
Yeah, I think it's different because, of course, the crisis is very different from the two world wars in terms of how the French are experienced it. It was such a sort of person. The two world wars were, you know, felt very personally. They were invaded, occupied, etc. But I think that the larger point about an event that's held annually that allows a nation to kind of track its history, what was going on that year when the tour was being raced, etc. So events that are held annually, especially very important ones that are part of the cultural landscape for an entire nation, when they're suspended, it's an indication of a major crisis. And so now it was delayed 2 months, so it hasn't been suspended, but I think it becomes symbolic of the gravity of the situation. Yes, so, and you're absolutely right to point out that the only other times that the tour, well, the only times that the tour has ever been cancelled was during the two world wars. So were it to be cancelled, that would really reinforce the sense of the kind of critical public health challenge we're confronting right now.
You know, one of the great things about reading the book is you as a reader are as interested in, you know, the 1925 Tour de France as the 1995 Tour de France, perhaps even more so. Having sort of immersed yourself in, you know, the contemporary reports and finding out about the riders of the day and so on, do you have a favorite era and even a favorite tour?
Oh, wow. I have never thought of it that way. I mean, obviously, as a Merckx fan, I loved Merckx, but then I also loved it when Ocaña won his tour in 73 after having crashed out in 71. We were living in Belgium then, and that was the first tour that my brother and I really watched sort of every day. And so I think there's something about the 47 tour, the very first post-World War II tour that was won. Back then you had national teams and French regional teams, and it was won by a tough little Breton, good climber, and he was newly married, Jean Robic, and he was not at all one of the favorites, and he wasn't even good enough to be picked for the French national team, so he was on the northwestern team, the Breton team, if you will, and he ended up winning at the very end of the 3 weeks, attacked, I think, on the last day, and prevailed. And so he became this kind of symbol of, you know, French regeneration after this horrific World War II experience. So there's something, there's something about his victory, if you're a historian of France, and that does resonate.
And Robic is on the jacket of your book, in fact, as well.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, because he was sort of this common, tough little guy, and not sort of, you know, certainly not good-looking film star.
No, not
type
glamorous at all, was he? No.
No. In fact, one of his nicknames was Tête de cuir, leatherhead, because he had crashes, and I think he had scars. And,
yeah,
I think he was prematurely
was
balding,
he the
perhaps
the hobgoblin of the Brittany Moor as well, was another nickname. of his.
Oh,
something
yeah,
like that. I think.
I think so. Yeah. And then Jean le Hargneux, sort of John the Hargneux. La Hargne means, you know, determination. So there was something about his spirit that coincided perfectly with what the French wanted to look up to at that time.
There's a great story in there about Caen, the city of Caen, and how, you know, the tour going there was very significant, and it was kind of in ruins. And I think the final stage go from Caen to Paris. Is that right?
Yes, I think that's right. But in 52, the organizers tried to finesse the whole. I think tried to finesse the whole World War II collaboration experience by having the final stage go from Vichy to Paris.
Mm. Well, I could talk to you all day because that also is a very interesting story. Well, and the whole mystery around why it went there.
I went through all, you know, archives, any archive I could think of. I went to Vichy and did research there. I couldn't find any document in the municipal archives in sort of an exchange between the organizers and the municipal council that explicitly articulated, yes, this would be great because then it would kind of get people to forget what Vichy represented in World War II. And we could link Vichy to the traditional capital of a free France, Paris.
Well, that was Chris Thompson, Professor of History, and really fascinating. And I think we'll be returning to him because he knows an awful lot about the history of the Tour de France and all the different aspects of it.
His French is better than mine.
I think the key is the fact that it's sourced from contemporaneous newspaper reports. I mean, I know we could joke about the media perhaps not reflecting reality as truthfully as it sometimes might. I mean, but you can't really do better than going back to, that's the closest thing you have to the horse's mouth. And so all of those reports about how things were in the early part of the 20th century are the most faithful remaining accounts of how things were. And it's very difficult to kind of contradict and go against those because there's no one around now to say it was any different. So a thorough historical account of the tour. I'm looking forward to reading it. I think after the tour, I'll take it home with me, Rich.
I'll lend you my copy, Lionel. Well, you've been listening to an episode of Kilometre Zero, powered by Zwift. Thank you very much to them for their support of the Kilometre Zero series at this Tour de France.